Support for Class Dismissed comes from School Status. School Status is the only K-12 data analytics platform designed to turn analysis into engagement. To learn more about how School Status can change your school district, head over to schoolstatus.com. You are listening to Class Dismissed, episode 48, and I'm your host, Nick Ortego. New research suggests there's a critical window for learning a language. A judge rules on whether or not teachers should be subjected to random drug tests. And a high school was offered $25 million, but the strings attached were outrageous. Stay with us. Dismissed is the podcast that inspires educators through story. Each week we cover some of the hottest topics and news in the world of education, plus we speak with a guest with a bright idea for education that you can apply in your community. This week, our guest tells us that storytelling may be a dying art in the classroom, and she's here to explain why. Hello, everybody. Nick Ortego here, and I'm joined by teacher extraordinaire Lissa Pruitt and education data expert Russ Davis of School Status. Lissa, how you doing?
I'm great.
Russ, how are you? Are you on the road?
I am on the road. I'm sitting in a hotel room in California as we speak.
Nice. Still sounding nice and clear, though. You're coming through. Hey, isn't it Cinco de Mayo this Saturday, right?
Yes.
Is it Saturday?
I think it is, yes.
Lissa was telling me that she's planning a... I didn't respond when she told me before the show, but now I want to talk about it. Is it Mexican dominoes?
What? Mexican train dominoes.
Is this a thing?
It's a game. With dominoes.
Okay.
It's what dominoes were intended for. Instead of stacking them up and knocking them down on each other, it's the true domino game.
Then why do they call it Mexican train dominoes?
There's different ways to play dominoes, and so this is one of the ways to play it, is where you basically, there's visually a circle.
This isn't
in the
culturally
center.
Insensitive, is it?
No.
Okay.
And there's...
We have researched whether this originates in Mexico, right?
I have no idea.
Cinco de Mayo, it doesn't.
Anywho, basically each player ends up making a long line of their dominoes, connecting them by numerical way. And so then you end up having a train, you know. I feel like you're making fun of me hosting a Cinco de Mayo domino party. But
sounds wild.
I just have so many questions about how you became such an aficionado, because not only do you know, obviously, Mexican dominoes, but you said there are many ways to play dominoes. I'm just curious about whether you're on a circuit of some kind.
Yeah. You subscribe to the domino Reddit thread?
No, but I do love to play games, and I do love
to play. Probably pizza on dominoes, frankly.
Yes.
On Reddit, rather.
Yes.
I'm sure there's an under society of dominoes somewhere, but I do like to just play games. I think it's fun to play, especially with adults, because everybody acts so ugly. I do. I am very competitive.
It's true. If you want to lose friends, play Monopoly with them.
I do not like Monopoly. Yeah. Yeah.
I've never played a single Monopoly game that finished to the end. It always ends up with somebody turning the board upside down. Expletive, I'm out. Yeah.
Good times. Let's jump into the teacher's lounge where they don't allow Monopoly.
Oh, is that me?
That's you. You're
okay,
up.
Sorry. Well, you know, one time when you went to the teacher's lounge, you like trumped me. You went to someone else. Anywho, did you guys know that there's research shows that there's a window of time that you can learn a foreign language and be pretty successful at retaining the knowledge that you've learned?
So you're basically saying, like, we can no longer learn a foreign language.
Right. So really, I'm saying I blew it big time, because I think the proof in this article is to try to expose your children to it also, or in schools, and because they're able to pick it up more. But research shows that after the age of 18, that it just really narrows. And part of the reason is because you're not learning any, you know, you're learning, your time to learn, your set aside sanctified time for learning has kind of ended. Mm-hmm. And you're in a job related activity or whatever, to where you're not really actively trying, maybe after the age of 18. But there is a lot of research that says that early exposure and being able to use...
So is the window up till 18? Is that it? Or is it...
Well, they're just... The proof in the journal Cognition says that there's a significant drop after 18. So they do, of course, as any great body of research does, they do say that there are people that... are able to, that are completely, you know, that they do fine. People that they even reference people that learn a foreign language and become intelligence officers and things like that.
Right.
But they do, the way they test it is they give them some kind of grammatical sentences that are misused, and they give them in foreign languages, and if you can use it correctly in the language that it is, without, you know, misusing the verb or whatever, then they, that's one of the ways that they show that people that started learning the language at a younger age are able to do, to conjugate and things a little more successfully, whereas if you learn it as an adult, it's just, that's a barrier you never quite break through.
I mean, I like to think that I probably couldn't, I kind of know a little Spanish, like I could find a restroom in Mexico and stuff like that, but baño. I like to think if, yeah, baño, right? if I went to a foreign country, I would guess in 3 months, I would be okay. Like if I had no choice, like I had to figure it
immersion.
Out. Yeah. Yes. But I don't know. You're saying I'm a little old for that.
I know. And if my mom is listening, which she's a huge fan of the show, not because I'm on it. Let me just say,
she likes Russ.
She does. She always talks about what a great job Nick does, and I'm like, what? Like anyway. So anyway, my mom. She works for the State Department, and she has learned many different languages when she is put in an embassy in different, right. you know, areas. And so she would probably argue that, nope, you know, you can still learn at any age. And I know that there's research that proves that it's really good for your brain at an older age to learn something new like that, to kind of exercise parts of the brain that you may not exercise anymore.
So there's a lot of research that talks about there's a concept called neuroplasticity, that is, you know, kind of your brain's ability to adapt and change. And there's a lot of research that talks about neuroplasticity and learning a second or third language. And it's interesting that you mentioned that 18 is kind of this this wall that folks hit, which you could still climb over the wall, but it's a lot more difficult, I think is probably a good analogy, is because neuroplasticity really starts decreasing past adolescence. So once you start becoming an adult, your brain's ability to adapt and change the way that it thinks in a fundamental way. What you're talking about is like if you're going to a different country and you speak a language and you don't have an option to speak your own language, it's called immersion. And it's actually one of the best ways to teach children who are new to the United States. A big part of that is immersion. So they put you in a classroom, and certainly you have a tutor at certain times during the day kind of teaching you the specifics. But hearing the language and somebody drop a pencil and say, oops, and knowing that oops is something I say whenever I make a mistake, that sort of thing. That's something that children have an easier time picking up, but they do require some tutoring to be successful and learn. English is one of the toughest languages to learn, I'm told. But learning like the nuances and things like that are very important. But it's really important that you read to your children, because that neuroplasticity is at an all-time high whenever they're very young.
The study was co-authored by Josh Tenenbaum, who is a professor of brain and cognitive sciences at the Massachusetts Institute of Technology.
So, Nick, can I completely change directions here for a second?
Please, yes.
I would like to talk about urine. more specifically, urine tests. Apparently, the District of Columbia, for all child providers, not just teachers, but preschool teachers, that sort of thing. So not just public school, but any regulated profession that kind of comes in contact with kids, there is a mandatory random drug testing policy. So
after employment.
After employment, that's correct. So, you know, you could be working for someone. You know, of course, we're familiar with, you know, getting a drug test, you know, drug screen pre-employment. But, you know, it's fairly rare unless you work in a profession that, you know, you drive a truck or you work in, you know, with dangerous machinery or something like that. It's generally pretty rare to get random drug tests. And so essentially, the D.C. Office of State Superintendent of Education, which licenses nurseries, they issued a memorandum that basically said that everybody would be subject to urine screening or they could lose their license if they refused. There was a school that was the River School, which didn't have very many kids, only had about 200 kids, and a lot of them had ocular implants. So it's like a special needs school. And they challenged, they only had a few actual teachers there, but they challenged it and won. So the U.S. District Court Judge Boasberg agreed that it was a unique risk to personal privacy. So, which is really interesting because there are states handle drug testing differently. And usually if there's like an accident or workman's comp and there's a drug test, the school argued against that, you know, we're not working with, you know, 100-ton locomotives here. You know, we're working with, you know, students. So, you know, the likelihood of them getting injured because of, you know, somebody on drugs or something like that is fairly low. But also just the fact that it is so heavy-handed to say that everyone will be subject to random drug testing without suspicion. Like if somebody comes on campus and they may have been drinking or you suspect they're high or something like that.
Right. You can smell it on them. You kind of, yeah, but just to randomly select people, it's a little different.
That's it. I think if there's like due process. So,
yeah. Well, and here you have a case, I guess, with a federal ruling. I suppose it could have some precedent in other districts, or at least a case that you could point to if you were fighting this.
Yeah, that's it. Yeah, you could point to the case. Generally, they are, unless they issue some sort of injunction that is far-reaching, then generally it doesn't apply to the outside of their district. And usually what happens is another district, U.S. Court district, will interpret it differently, and then they will essentially bring it to the Supreme Court that's what the Supreme Court largely does, is they figure out who's right and who's wrong in the federal appellate level.
So here's the question. Lissa, should you be able to randomly drug test teachers?
I don't know. I've been sitting here thinking about this the whole time. I've never done drugs or whatever you do it or taken. I don't know.
Clearly.
Nobody's ever.
It's pretty obvious.
Yeah. I know. Like, I've never even been asked. Like, I've never even been in a situation. There's no guy in the dark alley being like, hey, kid, you know. So
that's what we were told
in drug ed a long time ago. But my point is, it's like I've never even been around it. Like I know from my children being athletes in the local school district that they have to randomly drug screen. So I'm, you know, trying to understand what would they be looking for? Will it affect their job, you know, like the work that they do, you know, like, cause I know that, I guess, I know this is embarrassing, but I have no idea how long it even stays in your system and what is what, I don't know. I've seen Breaking Bad. I've seen that season.
She qualified.
And he was a teacher. Anyway, so.
But he never did drugs. So.
I know. And it's not a true story, but I'm kind of wondering like, okay, so. I don't know. What if a teacher goes to like Jamaica for her 10th anniversary with her husband? And I'm not even trying to stereotype.
That's a very specific thing to say, by the way. Like, are you sweating a recent trip that you've taken?
No.
To Jamaica? Yeah. But let's say that they visited California, where I am.
Okay.
And let's say that they smoked pot, which is decriminalized here, or they went to Las Vegas, which has recently decriminalized possession of marijuana. And they came back to, you know, Alabama or Georgia or Mississippi or one of these states that cracks down, you know, I don't know the rules, but I can imagine that, you know, you would have to show some sort of cause. I'm unaware of all my work with school districts from a school district that if you are not a bus driver or working with heavy machinery or something like that, I'm unaware of random drug testing or even pre-employment drug testing.
Right. There's fingerprints
But would you? I've never been drug tested.
Let's boil it down, though. Would you guys be okay with randomly drug testing teachers?
I guess what I'm trying to say is, from someone that really doesn't know anything about drugs and has never done it, I still don't think you should do it. You know, I'm sure there's people that are like, no, don't do that because they did go to Vegas, you know. But like even on the movie The Hangover, like that guy was a history teacher. So that means if he had gone back and gotten randomly drug tested, then he could lose his job over a bachelor weekend in Vegas. Like, you know, that did that affect his job? No.
I worked for a private company, and I remember when, I forget which state it was, Colorado or whoever at first started to legalize marijuana, I asked somebody in the HR department with the company I worked for, I was like, so does this, are we going to change our policy? Because what if somebody, you know, went over to Colorado, legally smoked marijuana, then applied for employment with the company? And she said, well, we believe as a company that no one who does drugs should work for us. So we're keeping the same position we've always had. It doesn't matter if it's legal or illegal. As a company, we feel like it shouldn't happen. I don't know if that changes things. And that's pre-employment. You know, we didn't have random drug testing.
Right.
My opinion is that it's really none of the government's business. As long as it's not affecting someone's work.
Right. That's
then
what I mean.
It really isn't the government's business what somebody does in their own personal time.
Right.
Obviously, if they get caught and they, you know, get perp walked or they get put on the news media or something like that, then they become a distraction from educating kids and you have to make a decision then you know. Right. But I think for most folks, you know, I just don't think it necessary. And it's very expensive for a group of people that probably aren't, you know, taking drugs on a regular basis. But I think schools have bigger problems to fight than, you know, catching somebody who went to Las Vegas and, you know, smoked pot, you know, and came back. And then a week later, they've got to sweat their job.
Right.
You know, I think that there are some ramifications that you have in life. But if it's not affecting their job, I guess really, you know, my view is, and I'm pretty libertarian when it comes to this, like, what business is it of the government? Which is really the schools are the government, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, like, you know, if we're talking about public schools, they are a government body. So what business is it of the government, what they do in their kind of their personal time?
The judge agreed with you, I think. So you know when schools get, like, big donations from alumni who have lots of money, do you guys think that there are strings attached, usually?
I don't think there often is on the forefront like that you can see, they're probably, I know from my personal experience, whenever there is a donation made from a corporation, there is usually a consideration to use those products in the future or even make sure you have a newspaper
unspoken
article kinda. That, you know.
What do you think, Russ?
I think it's often written. I think that, like, whenever entities give money, honestly, if I was Mark Zuckerberg, and first of all, I wouldn't be talking to either of you.
Okay. You are not invited to my
He wouldn't make a good podcast. I'm just saying. He's kind of,
I would,
kind of sounds like Kermit.
I would, you know, whenever I gave money to, you know, school districts, which he's given a lot of money to school districts, and they just gobbled it up and nothing really changed in a lot of places. But whenever I gave $10 million, there would be a whole hell of a lot of strings attached to it simply because I know how schools work. And sometimes grant money is not considered, it's considered other people's money. And so it can get, you know, not used.
I hear you. Well, all right. So I'm going to give one to you where I kind of agree with what you're saying, Russ, but this one will probably rub you wrong. So there was this billionaire, his name's Steven Schwarzman. He is the head of the Blackstone Group.
I don't like him already.
Yeah. So he's amassed $12.2 billion fortune, according to Forbes magazine. And he wanted to give $25 million to his alma mater back in Pennsylvania, Abington High School. So he says, you know, I'm going to give you guys $25 million. Well, the terms of the initial agreement were picked up by the Washington Post. And this is what the school would have to do. It would receive a new name. It would become the Abington Schwarzman High School. And for the avoidance of doubt, officials would make sure the name was displayed at a minimum at the front and above each of the six entrances. Parts of the campus would be named after his brothers, a former high school track coach, and two friends on the track team. Schwarzman's portrait would appear prominently in the school. Schwarzman would have input into the construction of the new campus, which is going to be done, which would be done in 2022. And also he would be able to approve contractors. And he would receive a regular report on progress of a computer literacy initiative, which is the only thing I would agree with. Like, I want a report that you guys are spending this for good educational purposes. And the agreement would be kept secret unless Schwarzman approved its release. So, well, they didn't agree to it. They turned down the $25 million. And then the initial agreement has been leaked. It just makes you wonder how often this happens. where somebody just wants their name on a building.
And well, this is now extreme. That happens
a lot. It happens a lot in higher ed.
Yeah.
But I mean, is it done in writing? Is this a normal thing?
Oh, you know? Sure. And honestly,
very much so.
I mean, I will say, like, our local high school desperately needs a new turf for the football field. Mm-hmm. And, you know, they're constantly asking, you know, who can do this? And we'll put your name all down the side of that football field. And you know what? If State Farm wants to pay $400,000 for the football field to get new turf, it should say State Farm down the sides, you know? Like, why not? So I don't think that's weird for it to be in writing that the building's going to be named after a track coach or whatever, you know? But
but when the person is donating the money, like selecting people and brothers.
Now, yeah,
like,
the
weird.
Whole thing about selecting of contractors.
Who does the construction.
Yeah, that's like, a that little eek, you know, because I wonder, you know.
I just like to think if I ever had access to that type of money that...
They'd just put your name on the building without you asking.
Yeah, I could just give it away and not have anything,
I'm sure that does happen. I do think that does happen. I do think people say, you know, like Chance the Rapper said, you know, what do you need? Tell me what you need. Tell me what you want for your specific school. And it doesn't have his name on it. You know, he gave them the money. I do think that happens. But this is the reason this is newsworthy is because it's a black eye for Blackstone.
Yeah. No doubt.
Well, my question is like this happens a lot. They're in the form of endowments for higher education. And so, you know, I think a lot of the controversy recently has surrounded like the Koch brothers have, you know, David and Charles Koch have given a lot of money to colleges. You know, part of me says if it were my money and I gave money for a very specific certain cause, and more importantly, the schools don't have to accept that cash, then what is the case? I think the guy in that case is probably some self-aggrandizing person, in my opinion,
clearly,
who wants his name on something and wants to have, you know, top-down control of the entire project for only what is $25 million. I'm going to be honest, it's not a lot of money, you know, for a major school system.
It is for one high school. If it's going to one specific high school, I guess that's a big chunk.
I don't know. How much did it cost? I don't really know for like a nice high school, how much it costs to build a new high school, I guess. That's my question.
Yeah. I mean, like a really nice building seems to go for anywhere between 25 and 50 million. And it's just from what I know about big buildings and stuff around here. So.
Yeah. So I guess that's my question.
That's a lot of money. Gosh.
You know, is it a lot of money? If it cost, let's say that a campus costs $60 million, right? Then is it a lot of money in the scheme of things with, I don't know. I would have said no too, frankly. It's like, we really appreciate the opportunity at the donation, but you know, there's some things that whenever we accept the money, it really becomes our money and we should have some say so over how it's used.
Anyhow, just kind of, you don't always realize that stuff is going on. Are you guys ready for the bright idea this week?
Yeah.
Sure.
We have our first overseas guest.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. It's pretty exciting. She actually wrote a really interesting article about how storytelling is a dying art in the classroom. And it's her specialty. She's an expert on it and she's from England. So we will bring her in for the bright idea.
I love storytelling.
Our guest in today's bright idea segment is a postdoctoral researcher and arts practitioner at York St. John University in England. Catherine Heinemeier recently penned an article that's called The Dying Art of Storytelling in the Classroom, which was featured on theconversation.com. Catherine, welcome to the show.
Thank you, and thank you very much for inviting me.
We're so excited because you're our first overseas guest. You're talking to us from England, so you know, this is our 48th show, so really, kudos to you.
Absolutely, and it's the kind of conversation that can only be enriched by international dialogue, I think. I think it's something where different education systems can really learn from each other.
I agree with you. And we talk a lot about different education systems from around the world on the show throughout all of our episodes, really. And in your article, I'm always skimming through looking for different topics. And your article really hit a soft spot for me because I truly believe in storytelling. And to hear you say and your research kind of back up that storytelling seems to be dying in the classroom some. You feel like it's endangered. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I think it's dying at all levels. People might not expect to hear storytelling as the word is conventionally understood very often in secondary school, but it's also certainly in the UK, I'd say it's an endangered species in primary school and even nursery schools, as well as an agenda of performativity and measurement of results takes over. I think storytelling is a casualty of that trend in education.
And so when you talk about storytelling, just so we're on the same page, we're not just talking about reading a book to a classroom full of students. We're talking about using stories to help convey lessons, correct?
Absolutely. I'm talking about a whole continuum of storytelling that starts at ground level with a teacher sharing a little anecdote of his or her life experience to illustrate a certain point or to show the students the real life relevance of a certain topic, right up to telling longer stories, reading longer stories. And in the middle of that, in the dialogue between those two, encouraging students to share with each other and with the teacher their own life experience or their own secondhand experience from things they've read or heard that illuminates a topic and sets all sorts of connections, learning connections going within the classroom.
In your article, you describe classroom lessons from pre-1960s and how they were very different from where we are today.
Yeah, so important to say at the start, I'm definitely not saying we should return to the way that teaching was done in the pre-1960s era. However, I think that in throwing out some of the things that were done in that era, which was often perhaps authoritarian and very teacher-led, in throwing out some of the bad there, we're also throwing out the baby with the bathwater. So lessons certainly in the humanities, particularly history and geography, in the pre-war period, pre-60s period, often relied really heavily on the teacher's own knowledge and the teacher's ability to communicate that knowledge compellingly. So the teacher might have knowledge from books, from learning they'd done. There weren't a vast number of other information resources in the classroom. There were some books, but there wasn't a whole internet to rely on. And it was very much up to the teacher what he or she taught to the class, what he or she thought the class needed to know. So the teacher would take their knowledge of a complicated topic, the English Civil War or the situation of developing countries or whatever it is, and would tell the pupils that knowledge. And in history particularly, a very pedagogy was for the students to hear that account of the teachers and then write it down in their own words or retell it in their own words. And you could say they were maybe relying too heavily on the teacher's version of events. You could say they didn't get much of a chance to critique what the teacher said. But what they did get a chance to do was to get really absorbed in the teacher's account of events. And if the teacher was good at that, the teacher would really bring to life what that different reality, that different time period, that different country was really like to experience, and the pupils would be able to enter that imaginatively. And when they write their own account of it afterwards, they're not necessarily just copying, they're making sense and they're appropriating for themselves an understanding of what that different reality was like.
Why was all of this an important topic for you to research and look into?
I think pupils need to be able to get to grips with complexity, and stories really specialize in complexity. There's a whole different kind of knowledge that is, or it's a whole different path to knowledge, listening to a story. When you listen to a story and get absorbed in it, you're getting into the nitty-gritty of a particular situation. You're seeing how different forces and different intentions and different agendas interacted and intersected, and you're understanding the particularities of that situation. So you can get way more in depth into a complex situation than you could if you were just trying to abstract general points. So it's the difference between hearing a story about rainforest dwellers who are in conflict with each other because some of them are indigenous and some of them are loggers and some of them are government officials, and really getting into the different intentions and the different needs in that situation, and being asked to produce a set of bullet points about the issues challenging rainforests. There's a whole different level of depth there, and pupils need to get into the nitty-gritty of particular situations if they're really going to appreciate what's at stake? What are the solutions to some of the problems facing us now?
What I like about your article and your research is you don't just say this is a problem, storytelling's endangered. You kind of offer some suggestions of what direction we need to go. And am I saying this right? You refer to this as layered learning?
Yeah, I think that it shouldn't be seen as an either-or choice for teachers. Should they approach something through narrative or through what are becoming more conventional means? I think you can layer a story with a set of facts, and that will bring a lot of richness to people's understanding. So, for example, I had a class of students I was working with who were studying the challenges of developing countries, specifically African countries. I told them a story of a true story of a young barefoot entrepreneur called William Kamkwamba. He's published his own book about his windmills that he invented right in the middle of a famine that his part of Malawi was enduring. And he was kicked out of school because he couldn't afford the fees. But using some twilight access he had to some books in the school library, he managed to construct windmills out of resources that were available on the rubbish dump. And he managed to generate the first electricity that had been available to his village. And he faced a lot of problems, a lot of prejudice and a lot of criticism on the journey. And that was actually a real sort of classic hero's journey story that the pupils got really, really engaged with. And so then they were able to layer that with the other information resources that the teacher was bringing to their attention. And what we tended to find was we would get a lot of answering stories from the pupils and then also answering questions. And I should add, I was working mostly with very low ability pupils, the ones who are regarded as having additional learning needs. But we were getting into some really in-depth questions about justice, economics, institutions and society. We were really getting into some nitty-gritty stuff. And we would often find the teacher and I that they would want to know what next. They'd want to know what would be the action steps or the ways out of that. And they'd want to research online the ways of helping people facing these kind of problems, for example. And it became a very holistic learning experience for them for that reason, I think.
And I know that, I guess, you and your co-researcher, it's Matthew Reason. You guys have this term you call story knowing. Is that kind of the same thing as layered learning, or is that different?
Yeah, I think what we're saying is that story knowing is this different track to knowledge. So we have a sort of a more scientific or propositional track to knowledge that is more celebrated in our society. That's about extracting general principles. But then there's this other track that's the narrative track, and we're calling that story knowing. So story knowing, to sum it up, its purpose is not so much to convey facts accurately as to convey experience meaningfully, to help the listeners, to help them stitch on their own knowledge to the new things that they're hearing and to see the sense of it. And that's a very collaborative process between the storyteller and the story listener. Even in the smallest little anecdote a teacher might tell her class, she's looking into their eyes and she's seeing where they're hooking onto it. And she's seeing that they're helping her make sense of it. And they're giving her feedback as she speaks with their eyes, with their body language, maybe with their voices too. And the kind of knowledge that generates is not reducible to categories. It's something more complex, more in-depth, something that's slower burning and stays with pupils and they keep making sense of.
So if you're a teacher and you know that, you know, it's the popular thing to do is to get students actively learning and getting their hands on things and not necessarily just listening to a teacher talk. But what would be your advice to a teacher who had a lesson and had a lecture to do? What would you say to make it a better storytelling lecture?
Right. That's a really good question. I mean, one thing I'd say is you don't need to be an amazing storyteller to get people really listening. There are certain kind of trigger words signal to us as human beings, you're about to hear a story. Like if someone says, well, I'll tell you how it was. Or even somebody just says, so, and then they launch into it. You see that everybody starts to listen differently. And pupils will listen to that. And I think part of the answer to your question is teachers should just trust themselves more and trust in their own instincts and the relevance of their experience more. But also, I think that sometimes have a bit of an oversimplified idea of what active learning is. We think of people as learning actively if they're constantly answering questions that we're asking them. But they might just be active if they are looking in a really absorbed, dreamy state and they're actually making all these connections in their head. Like one of the young lads in the one of the classes I work with, he said to me, he was very concerned because he thought that I would think he wasn't paying attention because he had his hands down on his head and he was leaning on his desk and he looked, to all intents and purposes, like he was asleep. And this was quite a naughty boy often. Mm-hmm. And he was very worried that I would think he was being naughty and disrespecting me. And he said, you know, when some of us do that with our heads, it's not because we're not listening. That's actually when I'm working really hard. That's actually when I'm making all the images in my head. And I think that is an important thing for educators to keep hold of, that maybe the biggest compliment to our teaching style is a child staring into space and looking at the air in front of them, because there's a whole lot of work going on there in their heads.
Well, Catherine Hanemeyer, we appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. If somebody likes to keep up with you, you know, are you on social medias or do you hang out on Twitter?
Absolutely. I'm on Twitter. Yep, that's a good place to find me. And I also have a webpage called StoryKnowingWithAdolescents.net based on my PhD research in schools and in other settings as well.
Well, are you ready for our pop quiz?
I am ready for your pop quiz.
All right, first question. If students could only go to school for one subject, which subject should it be?
Oh my gosh. That's a really, really hard question. Do you know what? I'm just going to say what you actually would expect me to say, but I think it's also the only answer to your question. I think they should hear a lot of stories from different storytellers with different life experience, like a crash course, because I think all of those stories would burn for a long time in their imaginations and keep releasing energy over the years.
What are we not teaching in school that we should be teaching?
Oh, these are really hard questions. I think sometimes we're not teaching students to find their own inner directives, their own guides inside themselves as to what they should be learning, what they should be doing with their lives and making happen in the world. I think we're teaching them too much to respond to other people's instructions and not enough how to find their own inner directives.
What does every child deserve?
Every child deserves a teacher who kind of loves them, who loves them as a class and really, really thinks and reflects on where they're at as they grow and develop and what they need.
What do you think the biggest challenge is for today's educators?
I think it is the increasing pressures to achieve fast, demonstrable results that are measurable, and the way that acts against sometimes forces teachers to go against their own instincts as to what children need.
What's the best gift to give an educator?
A trust in their own knowledge of the children sat in front of them.
Which teacher changed your life?
Oh, I had a brilliant teacher, and actually he was a grumpy teacher and very provocative, and I'm sure some people in the class couldn't stand him. But it was when I was about 16, and we had a teacher for environmental systems, was the name of the course. And he went at a rate of knots. It was really hard to keep up with him, and he had ridiculously high expectations of us. He thought we should be making websites for environmental organizations and campaigning and doing active scientific research. And he was constantly disappointed in us. But he also gave us so many opportunities and stimulus to really challenge ourselves and to really be citizens, not to wait for our lives to happen, but be making them happen now in the present.
That's great. Make sure you go and tell him if you can.
Oh, I will. I think I did actually when I was about maybe 25 or so, and I'd had a bit of time to think about it all. Like I said, these things burn slowly in your mind.
Right.
I did write back to him and I said, you know, still going, mate.
Excellent. Last question, pen or pencil?
Oh, a lovely fountain pen that the ink really flows out of.
Well, Catherine, we appreciate you taking the time to chat with us. Really interesting perspective on storytelling. And I think it's a lesson that all teachers, you know, really can't forget, that to keep those stories flowing in the classroom.
Absolutely. Thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk to your listeners.
That's going to do it for this episode of Class Dismissed. We want to hear from you, so if you want to send us an idea or a comment, remember you can always email us at info@classdismissedpodcast.com. We're here to support educators, but we need your support as well. So if you like what you heard today, please be sure and hit that subscribe button, and we'd also love it if you'd leave us a 5-star review. Don't forget you can connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/classdismissedpodcast or on Twitter. Just search for us by typing in Class Dismissed. On behalf of Russ with School Status and Lissa representing all the teachers out there, I'm Nick Ortego, and I'll talk with you next week.
Class Dismissed!